You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In much of his fiction, Russell Banks has explored the dark side, exposing us to the voices of people on the fringes of life in novels like Affliction, The Sweet Hereafter, and Rule of the Bone. And he has returned to them in his latest, Lost Memory of Skin. It's published by Echo and tells the story of the kid, a 22-year-old who's been convicted of a sex offense and lives under a causeway in South Florida. Janet Maslin of the New York Times has said that the book is destined to become a canonical novel of its time. Russell Banks was here in October to talk about the book, and we are replaying that interview for you now. I began by asking him, even though you've strayed into other areas in your fiction, like abolitionism in Cloud Splitter or class warfare among the well-to-do in the reserve, you do keep coming back to outsiders and victims. What's their attraction for you?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I think their lives, I guess, light up my imagination in a way that other lives generally don't. I mean, in this case, I spend a good deal of time in Miami Beach, and I have an apartment down there. And about 4 years ago, stories started coming out of the Miami Herald and other papers about a colony of convicted sex offenders who, having served their time, were living in a colony under this causeway that I could see from my terrace.
All sex offenders?
All, yes. Regular homeless people weren't permitted there, actually. I mean, it really was strictly that. And it was done with the connivance and cooperation of law authorities and so forth there after they were out of jail. And so what you ended up with is a cluster of, at one time, nearly 100 men who ranged from sociopathic serial rapists to some poor old alcoholic who was urinating in a parking lot and got arrested for indecent exposure, which is a sex crime, to a kid who might have had sex with his high school girlfriend who was under 18, which is statutory rape. So it was a mingling of people. And in this kind of extraordinary spot under this causeway right on the bay, on Biscayne Bay, and I think what I started saying is that it lit up my imagination. I just started saying, what would it be like to be in that position?
It's interesting that the authorities encourage people to live under a causeway. You would think that they would try to find some kind of a halfway house.
Right. Well, they were dealing with the unintended consequences of good intentions, I guess. The regulations had been passed just a few years before that prohibited any convicted sex offender from living within 2,500 feet of wherever children might gather, which essentially meant they couldn't live anywhere in the city. And so there were three places available to them there under the causeway, I think Terminal G out at the airport or the Everglades Swamp.
So they become the equivalent of lepers in
modern
society.
Exactly. Pariahs, lepers, yeah. I mean, all those images kind of pop into mind when you start thinking about it.
And did you spend a lot of time with them?
I can't say a lot. I did the kind of research there that, I mean, I'm not an investigative journalist, and I wasn't approaching it from that point of view. I was approaching it from the point of view of a novelist who wanted to tell a story from the point of view of a person in that with that plight. But I wanted to know what it smelled like. I wanted to know what it was like with the rumble of vehicles going overhead day and night and day and night. What it looked like as the tide came in and the bay rose and it started to encroach upon their shanties and tents and so forth. And also the hierarchy that they had created for themselves.
How does that hierarchy work? Are the worst offenders the leaders or...?
No, actually, the worst offenders were the pedophiles, those who prey on children, and it was the same pecking order actually, which holds in prison.
They are considered the worst.
Yeah, yeah, and higher up in the hierarchy too were the kind of entrepreneurial types. I mean, you know, they had to charge the batteries of their GPS monitors on their ankles, and they had to charge many of them their cell phones and so forth. So there was a guy there with a diesel generator who was selling time on his generator to do this sort of thing.
And where do they get money?
Well, many of them have jobs, and in some cases, welfare, Social Security, and so on.
You said once, every book book, every work I do, I try to arrange it so that I don't know what I'm doing, so that I'm in new territory each time out. Every time I begin, I'm beginning at the beginning and starting over again, in a sense.
That's true.
And it worked that way here, too? You
especially
started off with,
here, maybe, yeah. In a way, I had gone to a place that was profoundly mysterious to me. I mean, it's the edge of erotic life that I myself had almost no insight into when I began. And that's really, I think, what drives me as a writer, is to begin with something which is profoundly mysterious to me. And only through the process of writing fiction can I seem to get to make coherent to myself.
Where did the title come from? Lost Memory of Skin.
Well, I think I wanted to point toward the dissolution of that line, that hard line, which has existed in the past between fantasy and reality, especially as it applies to our erotic life, and in largely through the takeover, really, of by the internet, of how we relate to one another, and in more particular way, the extension of that into pornography and the difficulty of even just staying away from pornography. And so the central character, is addicted to the internet, and more particularly to pornography. And so I wanted to go there and deal with that that erasure of that, and its replacement with a kind of gray zone that I think most people today increasingly end up entering and staying when it comes to their erotic life, sort of the digitalization of eros.
Is this a kind of an anti-internet novel?
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I don't have a position. I don't try not to judge.
Because one reviewer kind of described it as such.
Right. I think it points up certainly some very serious problems and dangers. In fact, I think you've got a person coming on a little later. I'd like to listen to that.
Misha Glennie.
Yeah,
yes.
To that point of view.
Well, the book begins with the kid, and you never give him a name, always just the kid?
No. Then there's the professor, and then there's, you know, various other
kids. Because that's the way they're referred to under the causeway?
Partly, but also I wanted to kind of lift the story up and out of its being just about Miami. I also call the city Calusa, but yet it is clearly based on Miami, and to give it a kind of fable-like quality.
So where would the kid fit in the hierarchy? He has a certain kind of innocence.
Yeah, and he would fit about halfway down, I think. He's not guilty of a violent crime. Violent crimes against adults would put somebody up near the top. And he doesn't commit a violent crime. And we don't know for a long time what, in fact, his crime is, but he's somewhere in the middle.
Did you ever give him a name?
You know, I never was tempted. I think from the very beginning, I was trying to find a level of reality. Let me put it another way. You know, the conventions of realism really go from like Emile Zola to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and I wanted to come down somewhere toward the Marquez side of the Gabriel Garcia Marquez side of the middle, so that I could really tell a story that had a kind of fabulous quality to it. Not surreal, but just a more universal kind
but
of
no butterflies around the
general. No, there aren't any butterflies or angels falling from the sky particularly, but there are these babes on blades, as he calls them, rollerblades, who do sail off into the sky at one point, and there's a hurricane, and there's all kinds of other things that happen.
My guest is Russell Banks, whose latest novel is Lost Memory of Skin. It's published by Echo, and the book opens with the kid going to a library, something he'd never done before, and under the pretense of trying to look up if there's a sex offender in his neighborhood, he gets the librarian to help him look up his former home, and he finds his mugshot and his name on the National Sex Offender Registry, and then he runs out. Did he have to enlist the help of the librarian because sex offenders are prohibited from using the internet?
No, I think he had to because he wasn't sure how to do this. I mean, he's barely literate. He's one of those kids who slide through school without ever having become literate, without ever having developed any kind of a skill set that would help them survive in a library. And I think that's the problem. He's fine, and he's using it on on using a computer to find pornography sites, but to find that was a little bit tricky. He also doesn't have a computer available to him until he goes into the library.
You take care to turn our normal notions of characters in your book on their heads, with both the kid and with the professor, who's an older man who teaches sociology and befriends a kid in the course of doing research on sex offenders. You have the kid being forced to reconsider everything he himself has come to believe. Mm-hmm. Should we feel sympathy for sex offenders?
I think we should feel sympathy for other human beings, and if we're going to speak in general terms. And then if this particular person evokes our sympathy as he evoked mine, then I'm certainly not unhappy. There are characters in here that I found it very difficult to feel sympathetic towards. I mean, like the shyster, who's a pedophile, and one or two others. But the kid is he's basically an honest human being. He's a decent human being. He's trying to figure out how to be a good man. And he's kind of funny. He has a kind of a witty take, a slightly skeptical, slanting sense of humor that I think makes him somewhat endearing.
Is he a more grown-up version of Bone from Rule of the Bone, the 14-year-old who ran away from a very difficult home situation?
You know, a few people have asked me that because the kid comes from a similarly I don't want to call it shattered, but barely functional home situation and family. And so in a sense, yes, I suppose so. Although, you know, Rule of the Bone was written back in the middle 90s. And in the intervening 15, 16 years, a lot has changed in America.
But you have one of your other characters, Dolores Driscoll, from The Sweet Hereafter, the school bus driver showing up in this book.
Yeah, you noticed. Well, I always wondered what happened to Dolores Driscoll. She was one of my favorite people, and at the end of The Sweet Hereafter, she's left in a kind of a lost... Well, she's living in the sweet hereafter, as she says, and I always hoped that better things would happen to her eventually, and they do in this book.
This novel has a very dreamy style. You shift between third person with dialogues in italics. Did that take you time to work out finding that voice?
Not really. It seemed to unfold pretty naturally from the start. I wanted it a close, intimate narrative. The close third where you know everything that the character is thinking and feeling and so forth, but it's a third person point of view and it's present tense. And then the dialogue is, you're right, it's in italics, and I think I wanted that so that the voices of the characters when speaking would step out from the exposition in a way that it doesn't with quotation marks.
You have a paragraph that you're prepared to read for us?
Yeah.
To give us a sense of what we're talking about?
Right. This is fairly late, but it kind of pulls a lot of things together at once, and it's about charging up the battery on his anklet and his GPS anklet that monitors him. It takes half an hour to fully charge his monitor battery, and during that half hour, the kid feels intimately connected to the millions of other convicted sex offenders, young and old and in between, rapists and child abusers and men who expose their genitals on a bus, public masturbators, voyeurs and escalator gropers, compulsive seducers of teenaged boys, coaches who couldn't keep their hands off their athletes, men who talked dirty in internet chat rooms to people they thought were teenaged girls and then arranged to meet them for sex, fathers and uncles who drunkenly reached out for their teenage daughters as they passed by the sofa, porn addicts and fantasists lost in the misty zone between reality and imagery, no longer able to tell the difference, all of whom at this moment have plugged their electronic shackles into outlets and are sitting in the bedrooms, living rooms, and basements of houses and apartments and mobile homes, in garages, homeless shelters, public parks, in airports and train stations, in waiting rooms, offices, and the back rooms of fast food restaurants and under causeways and overpasses, as if they were all trembling leaves on the branches, large and small, of a vast electrical tree that casts its shadow across the entire country.
You've said that, quote, there, but for the grace of something inexplicable, go I. And you come from pretty mean circumstances in Newton, Massachusetts. What saved you from becoming a Bone or someone like the kid?
Probably my mother. Probably the fact that I came up in the 1940s and 50s, and it was a little bit harder for a kid, a troubled kid as I was, turbulent and angry, to fall through the cracks. Their community was a little more unified in its attempt to protect children and teenagers, maybe especially.
And you were the first in your family to go to college, but you also worked as a plumber, a shoe salesman, a window trimmer. Mm-hmm. Anything you were particularly good at?
None of those things, as a matter of fact. My father was a plumber, my grandfather was a plumber, but they didn't pass much on to me, I'm afraid.
What got you started writing?
Literature, really. I fell in love with reading. I had run off at 18. I thought I was going to become a painter, an artist, and a visual artist. And I had run off at 18 and ended up in Miami the winter of 1958-59. And I thought what I was doing was running off to join Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and the Sierra Maestra of Cuba. But they marched into Havana in February 59 and didn't need me, as a skinny kid from Massachusetts who couldn't speak Spanish anyhow and had no idea how to get over there. But I started reading for the first time, really seriously reading, not just doing what I was supposed to do in school. I was a dropout at that time. And I fell in love.
And who were you reading?
I was reading almost alphabetically in the library, the public library. And you know, I was probably up somewhere around the H's with Hemingway at that time. But it was really that. And like a clever monkey, I started trying to imitate what I was reading and write short stories or poetry like Whitman or whatever was coming my way.
And
before I knew it, there I was.
And now we have this, your 12th novel. There have been other books as well, and a number of them have been made into movies, Affliction, The Sweet Hereafter, and I hear The Darling is being made into a film directed by Martin Scorsese with
Kate
Blanchett.
Well, he's executive producing it, actually. He's executive producing it. It's my screenplay with the director is Denis Villeneuve, a Canadian director who I'm very excited about.
And meanwhile, I'm assuming there's another novel on the way.
Yes, as soon as I come in off the road, I'm going to hole up, headed for Miami and hole up and try to get another novel done in another year or two.
Russell Banks, his latest novel is called Lost Memory of Skin. It's published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you, Leonard. It's always a pleasure.